Pete Hegseth, Secretary of Now War. I still have a hard time saying that and don't want to say that. Maybe I'm going to go back to the Department of Defense. It's technically, legally, it still is. But he addressed a group of defense industrial based executives, which just on the surface of it already got my antennas up and of worry, because we seem to always be paying a lot more attention to the defense industrial base and the economics of war. And right out of the bat, Secretary Hegseth did anything but allay my concerns.
Our objective is simple. Transform the entire acquisition system to operate on a wartime footing, to rapidly accelerate the fielding of capabilities and focus on results. Our objective is to build, rebuild the arsenal of freedom. American industry and its innovative spirit are begging to be unleashed to solve our most complex and dangerous warfighting problems. We need to get out of our own way, out of your way, and enter into real partnership with you, rather than overprescribe and decelerate your natural progress. In turn, industry needs to perceive business with the Department of War from the perspective of growth and assume risk to partner with the United States.
I'll tell you, Gary, this really is troublesome to me, and I want to highlight it maybe more than just a little bit. Because first of all, we had a change of name from Department of Defense to the Department of War. That changes the mentality. Trump even himself said it when he announced it. I want more offensive than defensive. I don't want to just do offensive. And for anyone to say we haven't been offensive in the previous couple of two or three decades is crazy. And if you want to go more than that, that by itself was alarming. Now here we have Secretary saying, I want to now get the defense industrial base on a wartime footing. So if you talked about changing the name on a building or on a placard in front of his desk to war, now then you're telling the defense industrial base to go on a wartime footing. That by itself is also alarming. And it sounds like we're going somewhere. And he says that the defense industrial base, the industry, should be aggressive in going down that path. What does that say to you?
I don't know. You know, I'm not sure, Danny. You know, part of it, he calls it an arsenal of freedom. I thought that's quite a way to couch it. An arsenal of freedom. If we weren't to go there, I mean, if this is it troubling that the language is too aggressive? Is that what rubs you the wrong way?
Well, it what rubs me the wrong way is that it's talking about war and we want a wartime footing. We're not at war. We shouldn't be on a wartime footing, because historically, when you prepare for war and when you get all the pieces in place, you get into a use it or lose it kind of situation, and you're more tempted to use it. And besides, look at Russia, for example. So on February 2022, they were not in their industrial base, was not on a wartime footing. They had the military forces and they went in there, but then they got their nose bloodied and punched in the face and realized it was not going to just be a demonstration. And now then, oh snap, they have to go to wartime footing. They had to completely retool their defense industrial base to a wartime footing. And then they went up to, I think it was like 12% GDP. We're at what, at 3.5 or something like that. Wartime footing means something more like 7 or 8% GDP and a massive expansion. That is not a minor word. Where are we going to find that money? And why do we need to have a wartime footing when we're not at war?
I don't know, Danny, do you see it as just a preventative approach rather than waiting till we're in the heat of the moment?
I don't, and I'll tell you why not. Because play that next soundbite.
There we go.
This is a 1939 moment, or hopefully a 1981 moment, a moment of mounting urgency. Enemies gather, threats grow, you feel it, I feel it. If we are going to prevent and avoid war, which is what we all want, we must prepare now. Our adversaries are not sitting idly by, they're moving fast. They're developing and delivering new capabilities at a rate that should be sobering to every American, especially those who work in the Pentagon and in the defense industrial base. Their ambitions and intentions are bold. Their actions speak volumes. And frankly, at times, we've been too damn slow to respond.
So he says this is a 1939 moment. Wartime economy. Those things go together. 1939 was the beginning of World War II. And there was a global conflict already exploded in both the Pacific and in the Atlantic. And that's what he's citing. And we should do that. And then he talks about all these enemies that are gathering everywhere, trying to connect today to 1939. And there is no global war going on. The only war going on of any substance is the one between Russia and Ukraine, which is localized between those two and should stop. And it's everything in our advantage to stop it. You talk about not wanting to go to war, then don't continue to expand the war. Don't continue to support this one here and then go on issues where we're going to test nuclear weapons. He's going to test nuclear weapons. All this language is just ramping up the rhetoric. And every time, and just imagine this, none of this stuff happens in a vacuum. If the United States says we're going to go up to this new 1939 level and advance our defense industrial base, Europe is already on this from several months. They want to rebuild Europe, $800 billion to expand their capacity. They're moving troops closer to Russia. What do we think Russia and China is going to do when they hear this stuff and they see Putin actions behind their word? Whatever they're doing that he was talking about, they will definitely accelerate it. And then now that you have people fearing the United States for the wrong reason, not respecting it, but fearing it and thinking they don't have any choice but to ramp up. That's part of what led to the beginning of World War One, because you had one side took a move, then another side, well, we can't stay still. We've got to take a move, et cetera. This is building up to a completely unnecessary and pointless war. And nuclear weapons are almost certainly going to be involved if we get there. This is catastrophic, I think.
Danny, would you be, you certainly be more at ease, but would it be different if they were doing that without explaining it out loud the way they are, making it in front and doing it behind the closed doors?
No, I mean, that just adds a little bit of fuel to the fire, but only a little bit. The issue is what you're doing. And when you continue to have the president talking about this stuff, and then as we see actually in this next clip here, this is coming directly from the president, which is adding another layer of concern.
The president recognizes one simple fact. America's military is the greatest in the world by far, and we must keep it that way. Our commander-in-chief is leading the way, affording us, this is what is so key in any effort like this, affording us the top cover to do big, hard, and necessary things quickly.
See, this is being driven by the president. So you had he directed the name change to the Department of War. And now then he's directing that we're going to accelerate our capacity and go on a wartime footing in the defense industrial base to build up more capacity. At the same time, he's sending troops down into Latin America, into the Caribbean Sea Basin. We are attacking boats down there. We're threatening to attack another country in Venezuela. We have already attacked a country in Iran. That's still ongoing, and that's an open debate. That could restart at any time. We're not closing down the war in Russia, Ukraine. In fact, we're continuing to give them more weapons and ammunition. We're not closing down the war in the Middle East, despite Trump's claim that he ended that war and there's peace all over the place in the Middle East.
Wars, Danny.
We're wars. Still giving them weapons and ammunition. The IDF is still attacking into Lebanon, still attacking into the West Bank, still attacking into Gaza, despite the alleged ceasefires. So all those things are going on here. And so you see Trump moving everywhere, and we could still be in a war in Venezuela at any time here. We don't know what's going to happen with that. We just had the U.S. Senate with Lindsey Graham talk about how that we should not have a constitutional prohibition, that the president should have freedom to do anything he wants. The 1973 War Powers Act doesn't apply. The constitutional war Article 1 doesn't apply, that only the Congress can declare war. If the Congress doesn't declare war, then the president is free to do whatever he wants. Lindsey Graham said that on Thursday of this week. All that together looks like somebody who is getting ready to use the military and wants to get rid of any kind of prohibitions. That worries me.
Yeah, you know what, Danny? I think in their minds, and I don't think if they were really trying to think they're pulling the wool over our eyes, that they've removed themselves. Like the Ukraine war, they don't have anything to do with it. You know, we're given the weapons to NATO. NATO's going to do whatever they want with those weapons. Same thing with Israel. You know, we're not doing it. So I think they actually think that we believe that there is no connection whatsoever between the U.S. military and what's going on, at least in those two battlefields.
Yeah. At least in those, and you know, like I said, the one in Iran is kind of suspended. Who knows if that's going to get restarted? We know that the one in the Venezuela area is definitely active and ongoing here. But yeah, I think there's lots of, attempts to wordsmith things and to make it sound like something else. Meanwhile, all of the guardrails are being shredded right before our eyes out in the open. No one's doing it behind the scenes. You've had the Senate having this vote, which was voted down the next day on Friday, by the way. So, or maybe it was even on Thursday. So those are now off the table. No one's going to stop him from doing anything he wants to do. And now then we see we're actually physically preparing to do more at a wartime level. And this needs to be called out.
Yeah. You know, I'm a bit conflicted, Danny, I got to say, because listen, and I think like you two, you want our military to be strong, but I think it just seems like there's a heavy-handed way to do it, and they're doing it the heavy-handed way, out loud in front of it, almost antagonistically, poking the bear, poking the world, basically, not just the bear, as to what's going on, where they could do it much more. It seems that they could do it much more subtly and carefully.
Well, that might be the case if there wasn't a Department of Defense, if we weren't doing anything, if we didn't have a baseline. We do. We have always, that's been for 250 years, the requirement for the Department of Defense to protect our country. That's never changed. It's an enduring requirement 24/7, 365. So we were already there to prepare our defense. Now, if you want to say that we had some shortfall somewhere, and we definitely did, I've been advocating for this for many years, have written articles on how we could reform and reorganize both the entire Department of Defense and how we fight with our doctrine, et cetera. Those things still need to be done, by the way. We have not responded effectively to the war fighting capacities. Do those kinds of things. That's how you can provide your national security. But to say we're going on a wartime footing and we're going to ramp up and do all this stuff and start cutting corners and get rid of bureaucracy and do it faster, those are words that you use when you're ready to fight. That is a categorical, clear distinction, and it is not just providing for national security. That's why I'm alarmed.
Yeah, it's the wearing their heart on their sleeve as far as war goes and manufacturing of the weapons.
And so that doesn't keep us safer. That doesn't provide defense. That just makes it more likely that our adversaries are going to be alarmed and they're going to take more action. And then you have this cascading and spiraling, actually, dynamic, which could then actually be the very war you claim to want to prevent. It lays the foundation for it.
Yeah.
That's what I'm concerned about. Let's move on to some other things that happened this week. Let's go to the president himself, since he's the one that directed this. And what he said here in terms of, this is actually kind of underscoring my concerns here. President Trump entered office. We're going to end this in a day and all that kind of stuff. And everything was supposed to be about ending it, Alaska and all that. Now then he's saying this week, you know what? Just let them fight it out.
Yeah. You know, Danny, he will hit upon themes and then he'll, you know, hammer it home over and over again. Well, it seems like this is his new theme.
We're both going to work together to see if we can get something done. We agree that the sides are, you know, locked in and fighting, and sometimes you have to let them fight, I guess. Crazy. But he's going to help us, and we're going to work together on Ukraine. There's not a lot more we can do. Sometimes you have to let them fight out. They're fighting it out. It's been a tough war for Putin. He's lost a lot of soldiers, maybe a million. That's a lot of soldiers. And it's been tough for Ukraine. It's been tough for both. Sometimes you have to let it, just
get bought out. So, Gary, you've been covering Trump forever. I mean, since you were at Fox News back in the first term and all that, and you've obviously been paying all lots of attention ever since that point. As best you can, using Trumpese, connect the dots for me. How do we go from being, I'm going to get this war over with in a day, to just let them fight it out after 10 months?
Yeah, well, again, you know, listen, in one sense, he's pretty transparent, although he changes all the time, that his changes are transparent. So we hear the changes every single time there's a change. But as I was saying right before we play that, as we all know, he will get into a phrase and then he'll hang on to that. And just, that's why I wanted to put them two together. So back in the beginning of October and now in the beginning of November, he's now latching onto the scene that, you know, let them fight it out. He even said, there's not a lot more we can do. So he's at the point of, you know, resignation, that, wow, it's not working. He has his pizzazz, his whatever kind of, what's the word I want? You know, you know, how somebody has great influence over things, and you know how he thinks he has great influence over everything, but he's realizing that his charm, that's the word I was looking for, his charm has just fallen flat. There is no charm anymore. There's nothing to do. How many times does he have to have conversations that end up with him coming home with nothing, basically? So I think it's settled in.
What is he trying to convey here? By fighting out, does that mean he's finally going to say, hey, we tried, so y'all just figure it out now?
Yeah.
But I think he's giving you weapons?
Yeah, and then, you know, he's washed his hands of the situation, basically. They're fighting. What am I? I'm not even part of this any longer, right? It's them. I tried to stop it, but, you know, no, there's not a lot more we can do. It's just let them fight. Rather than trying to, I don't know how much more he could ramp up negotiations and talks. In fact, in a little bit of a thought that we're going to have from Scott Horton is going to lay it out pretty clearly what he'd like to see done. But
what I was going to say is, even in the same breath on that soundbite you just played there, you have him saying, well, I think we're going to get something done. I think we're going to get this negotiated, but let them fight it out. I mean, those things are mutually exclusive. They can't fight it out and we're going to get something done. Those, you can't simultaneously have those things.
Danny, you listen, not in the Trump world, not in the Trump brain. You have to present both of them together as if they're not in a conflict.
But they are in conflict. I mean, does his followers, let's just keep with his supporters, because we obviously, the people who were not, point out things that are like that I did. But how in the mind of his supporters do they hear stuff like that and not say there's discontinuity there?
I think it's true. Blue supporters, Danny, believe in the heart of Trump. They believe in the, you know, deep down, he understands he's a good guy. He wants it to go well. I think that will supersede any of the words that comes out of his mouth.
Hard to argue with that, because the words keep coming out and the sport stays firm. So right. I guess that's the case. That doesn't do anything to the reality on the ground, though, as we saw this week in Pokrovsk. And by the way, before we play this next soundbite here, the current situation continues to get worse. As of this morning, there is about 95% of Pokrovsk has fallen. There's literally just a few neighborhoods on the northern and the northeastern side of the city. The rest of it is all in Russian hands, and they're cleaning up a few pockets in between. But they control virtually all of the city now. And then they've actually gained more in the that area up north of Pokrovsk that I've talked about, where they had closed off the Rodinska. They have actually taken more of that. So despite the Ukraine side counterattack to try and block that off and cut it off, the Russians actually pushed them back further overnight. And now then Mirnograd, the Russians have entered the northeastern part of the city of Mirnograd and in part of the southern part, and they're moving up in those fields in the south. Literally everywhere, it's starting to collapse, and those guys now are, their escape is now cut off. They don't have a path out, so they're either all going to die or they're going to be captured. So one or the other. That is what's going on inside Ukraine now, despite any words from anyone. And here is a soundbite, and I'm going to have to read this out loud, but here's what some of the Pokrovsk defenders have said after they got captured by the Russians. He said, I was captured near Pokrovsk. We were sent. The task was not explained to us well at the position. They did not explain what our task was. I'm looking for a moment. And why did they ask why he was surrendered? We learned that we were surrounded. They didn't drop us any water or food. I'm sick of everything. There was no way out, as I just mentioned. The shelling was intense when we realized that no one would evacuate us or save us. We decided to surrender. What advice would you give to your comrades? He says, do not die. If they are abandoned, surrender when possible.
You know, Dan, you almost don't even have to read the words that are here. You just look in their eyes. That's what's so captivating about this and so heartbreaking, that you can see what's the story's being told even without their words.
Yeah, I'll just tell you, I recognize that. One of the big battles that I fought, the Battle of 7-3 Easting in Desert Storm in 1991, February 1991, we captured a large number of Iraqi soldiers after a huge battle that was I won't even go into the details. It was basically a slaughter on the Iraqi side. We had hardly any casualties on our side, and we captured, I forget the number, maybe 175 different troops. And I actually interrogated a couple of them that came across because we wanted to know what had happened. And so before they got sent on to the professional interrogators, there was one guy that spoke English, apparently, that had been gone to school in the United States at one time. And he was a major, and that was, I guess, the ranking officer that was still alive. And so I asked him, you know, what had happened, what, you know, when we attacked, and how did they defend, et cetera. But in the process, I could tell him, but then all of these others, and I actually have photographs of this in my archives to this day, the look of shock and dismay on their faces is exactly what these guys have on theirs. I'm telling you, there's no difference, no matter the time, the nationality. When you have that shocked look of loss on your face, you don't need any words.
Hardly. None.